This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, the politics of flags, as Keir Starmer tells his colleagues to fly the flag on St George's Day. We ask, does it actually make a difference when you're trying to sell a policy if you've got a flag up in the background? We'll bring you a sneak preview of this week's episode of How to Win an Election, and we'll head to America, where there's another round of primaries happening, to check in on the progress of Donald Trump's potential return to the White House rather than the courthouse. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. A lot of pest news around in politics. First, there was Liz Truss's claim that Downing Street was infested with fleas. She was careful to say there was no conclusive evidence that it was Dylan the dog who was to blame. That's only because she knows that Carrie could definitely have her in a fight. But when he moved into his flat above Downing Street, Jeremy Hunt had to gut the place.
I replaced all the carpets at my own expense. Vast expense, because it had to be a security-cleared company that did it. So I'm pleased to say that the Hunt family has not had the flea problem.
Yeah, he's now ensured the carpeting was restored to the deep state. Now it's been reported that by Civil Service World, the Home Office is infested with bedbugs. Emergency legislation is now being drawn up to identify which bedbugs can be sent to Rwanda. Now, as we always do on Politics Without the Boring Bits, on a Tuesday, we'll bring you a little sneak preview of this week's episode of How to Win an Election with Peter Manderson, Polly McKenzie and Danny Finkelstone.
Now, I wanted to talk about positioning for the leadership, because there's a lot of it going on, jockeying, particularly obviously in Tory ranks right now. People think about what might happen after the next election. So what is the art, Polly, do you think, of How do you posture? How do you get yourself in a good spot? You don't want to be the front runner, because then everyone will come for you, but you don't want people to forget you exist. So what's the art of leadership posturing?
It's so tough, basically, to get the timing right. I mean, the reality is huge numbers of members of parliament want to be the leader of their party because, you know, that's actually a really normal, healthy ambition. But it's like you're not allowed to say it because you always get into hot water. And so I think it's one of those things that just grates with normal people watching politics, is anyone who's ever asked ends up sounding disingenuous and they do this sort of shy, coquettish blush and like, oh no, I could never do that. Like, oh, come on. The more you deny it, the more clear it is that that's what you want. And it just, if only we could have media reporting that didn't explode as, I'm pretty sure that Nick Clegg accidentally said something at the, you know, some fringe event and upset Min Campbell when Min Campbell was the leader, because he just said something normal, like, sure, if there were a vacancy, I'd be interested. And suddenly it's like, that's the only news story in town. And it's ridiculous. I think the best way to do it in that context ends up being basically like using lots of proxies, a source close to, which is usually you, or if not, somebody who happens to share a parliamentary office with you.
Peter, I suppose the obvious first question is, did you want to be Prime Minister?
It never, honestly, never occurred to me that I would become prime minister. Indeed, for most of my sort of early adulthood, I didn't think I'd even become a member of parliament. And that's in a sense why I went into the party headquarters. I thought I wanted to work for the party. I wanted to serve the party's interests. I wanted a career in politics. And that's why I became campaign director at a very early age. In the event, I thought I'd have one shot at becoming an MP. There were a variety of reasons why everyone pointed out to me that I was unlikely to be selected in Hartlepool in northeast England, but I thought I'd give it a go. Having done that and succeeded, it honestly never occurred to me that I would become leader. And I think one of the reasons here you've got to understand is that, you know, if you want to pitch for leader, it's as well to show leadership. And that doesn't always advance your interests in the party. Showing leadership means having ideas, having opinions, not sitting on the fence, being a lead to people, being more outspoken. And that can, frankly, result in you becoming a target in the party. It attracts opponents as well as support.
I think you might have talked about this before, Danny, but the problem is, why on earth then would you join a political party if you don't even get to choose the leader?
Well, people did. I mean, people were, there were many more members of the Conservative Party, for example, before these elections were held. But let me just go back to this original question of positioning the yourself for the leadership. First of all, there's always one of these things where people say you mustn't peak too early, which is one of my favourite phrases in politics. It's so ridiculous. I mean, most people don't peak at all, right? So, and you don't have much control, and you don't have much control about when you peak. You know, I was when the Conservative Party was going to defeat in 1997, people said, "Well, don't peak too early," and I thought, well, chance would be certainly a fine thing. People position themselves all the time for a sense. So let's take an example of someone who's positioning themselves as a leader, setting out positions that are definitely designed to appeal to to right-wing national newspapers, and to show themselves as as bold in contrast to their leader, and that's Wes Streeting. Okay, so he's doing that. The reason I point that out is that, you know, that's all. The other way of looking at what Wes Streeting does is he's setting out an agenda for what he's intending to do. He's showing himself to be creative. He's providing a bit of small L leadership, and so, you know, you can look at this in two ways. I think it's certainly true that. If you think the leader of the party is going to lose the next general election, you do gently begin to position yourself. And one of the best examples of that recently was Keir Starmer's position on Brexit, which shifted from his original position when he was appealing to sort of Corbyn and the Corbynites in order to be put in the shadow cabinet, to a position where he wanted to appeal the people he thought he could make him leader.
And if you want to hear the full episode of How to Win Election discussing how to pitch for the party leadership, just head over to How to Win Election wherever you're listening to this, but not before listening to the rest of this week's episode. And right now, we're off to America.
Election 2024.
The United States of America. And they are headed to the polls in Pennsylvania today for the 2024 primary there. And Daniel Lipman is White House and Washington reporter for Politico and guide of all things America for us often on the show. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about what do we need to know about Pennsylvania and why it's important?
So Pennsylvania is one of the important swing states that will determine whether Joe Biden is going to win in November. And so it will be interesting to see how many Democrats show up to the polls in their primaries today, because he has seen a lot of disaffected voters from his base kind of drop off because of Gaza, because of his age. And it's also the state of the center for a top Senate race that will determine control of the U.S. Senate between Bob Casey, the longtime senator from Pennsylvania, a Democrat, versus Dave McCormick, who is a hedge fund executive but lives in Pittsburgh.
And what does Pennsylvania then tell us about the rest of America? Is it a sort of state that's up for grabs? I mean, I suppose to some extent, because we know what's going to happen. Joe Biden and Donald Trump will emerge victorious at both of these. But it gives us a sense of the enthusiasm for them.
It does. It has. I'm here in Philadelphia, so that, you know, it's a very urban city in terms of a lot of minorities and black voters live in Philadelphia. But then the rest of the state can feel. Has some suburbs, but also a lot of rural areas where energy is a big issue. And so the fact that Biden has put on a pause for liquefied natural gas has not been very welcomed in those parts of Pennsylvania. And so it can feel like a very southern state with, in terms of the West, because it's socially conservative, it's fiscally conservative, it's, they are not fans of the big city, and so it almost can feel like Alabama the further west you get in Pennsylvania.
Now, the big question, of course, is it because it's Taylor Swift's home state, Joe Biden has been pretty openly courting her endorsement, but nothing so far. What are people saying about Taylor Swift?
Well, she endorsed Biden last time in 2020, and it helped him gain some votes. And when she told people a few years ago, hey, register to vote, thousands of people registered to vote. And so she is a cross-cultural phenomenon, and a lot of people look up to her. Being the top celebrity in the world, people tend to follow what she says. And so I think she is probably waiting to give her endorsement when it actually will matter. So not in April, but more in October or September, when people are starting to pay more attention to the presidential race.
When they're sort of tuning in. I suppose, lots of talk about what's about the White House, but we should probably talk about Donald Trump at the courthouse. He was pretty rambunctious, I suppose, is one way of putting it, on the stand on the first day of the Stormy Daniels hush money trial. Listen to what Donald Trump's been saying.
This is a witch hunt, and it's a shame, and it comes out of Washington. It's in coordination with Washington, everything, including the DA's office. It's in coordination with Washington. I just want people to understand that.
We've got another clip of him basically getting more and more cross about the fact this trial's even happening.
You know that's taking place in front of an extremely crazed judge who's the most overturned judge in New York State. He was overturned four or five times on that case alone. That's, you know who it is. I don't have to mention names. I want to be nice. I want to be very nice. But a thing like that, and a thing like what's going on right here should never be happening. It's a very, very sad day in America. I can tell you that. Thank you very much.
Very sad day for America. I mean, I suppose to some extent, Daniel, he's quite adept at turning even being in court into a political sort of rallying cry. But presumably he'd much rather be out on the campaign trail rather than stuck in the courthouse.
You're exactly right. This is someone who is not, his predisposition is not to stand, is not to sit silently in a courtroom for weeks on end and have to listen to witnesses and prosecutors attack him. He's a billionaire, so he wants to do what he wants. I think right now it hasn't hurt him politically. But if there's a conviction by his jury, a trial of his peers, then for a felony charge or multiple, then it becomes a real election liability, because there's a lot of Americans who say, well, I'm a little uncertain about these charges about Stormy Daniels, but if we still believe in a jury system, and we might not want to send a felon to the Oval Office, it might not look very good for America.
That's interesting how that all plays out. So give us a sense then, finally, Daniel, the sort of the timeline of where we go next in the U.S. political calendar.
So this trial is going to last for maybe 6 or 7 weeks. They're trying to work as fast as possible. But the big thing that I'll be looking for is in a few months in the summer is the conventions and how the speeches go and whether, particularly for Democrats, does the Gaza war, is it still happening? Because if it is, then we might see major protests in the arena and also outside in Chicago for Democrats.
Daniel Lipman from Politico reporting for us from America. Up next in our big thing today, we look at the politics of patriotism and flags, flags, flags.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
In the Labour Party, we've been very shy about patriotism for too many years.
I don't have any problem at all with the Union Jack.
The flag is used by everybody.
The Union flag, we do have a flag. The flag of the United Kingdom.
Flag,
the Union Jack.
Oh, he loves a flag. He loves a flag, Keir Starmer. He's been telling his party to fly the flag for St George's Day. In fact, in the last hour, he's now posted another video about it.
The symbol of St George, the St George's flag, belongs to every person who loves this country and seeks to make it better. A symbol of pride, celebration, belonging and inclusion. So on behalf of the Labour Party, I wish everyone a happy St George's Day.
In fact, Keir Starmer has written to all of his party's general election candidates, urging them to mark St George's Day with enthusiasm and to fly the flag. But why is he doing it? Does everyone in his party agree, not according to one poll, showing that one in eight 2019 Labour voters believe the St George's Cross is racist, divisive and should not be displayed? Of course, the Labour Party's relationship with St George's Cross is it's a mixed bag. Back in 2014, Emily Thornberry sparked so much fury for tweeting a picture of a house, some flags and a van with the caption, "Image from Rochester," that she had to resign from Ed Miliband's shadow cabinet. But now the flag is back. Labour, they keep telling us, is the party of patriotism. Patriotism? At least Keir Starmer keeps telling us. But will this work? We want to take a look at the politics of flags, flags, flags. And Professor Jane Green is director of the Nuffield Politics Research Centre. And I asked her if it's even really possible to properly measure how patriotic people are.
It's a good question. I think the way we think about measuring sort of strength of identities
is through kind of questions that say, you know, how strongly British do you feel, or how strongly English or European or Scottish or Welsh? And if you ask people to identify, and you say, you know, do you identify one of these three, one of these following things? The census did that and found around 15% of people identified as English in the country in the last census. So that's a relatively small number. You do tend to find using those measures that the people that identify as English also identify as British. So in that sense, you know, these things aren't mutually exclusive identities. The degree to which political parties can appeal on patriotism, I think, you know, that's trickier, obviously, to work out. If you isolate everything else that a party might be saying through their leader and through their policies and take away all of that other noise, what is the kind of additional effect of mentioning, you know, this kind of patriotic kind of themes? That's much harder. Colleagues at the British Election Study, Ed Fieldhouse, they've run a survey experiment showing people a message, either with a flag or without a flag. In this case, it was the Union Jack, not the St. George flag. And they found that indeed, this tended to be more positively received by Conservative voters than Labour voters if it was a Labour politician having a message with a flag. And I think there's lots of reasons to expect that a patriotic message focusing on national identity would appeal to precisely the kinds of voters that voted Conservative in the last election, and many of whom are now switching towards the Labour Party.
It's fascinating that. So it's the same message, just with or without a flag. Even though everyone sort of knows what they're doing, it does actually engender a more positive reaction.
Yeah, so what they were doing was essentially showing one group, here's a Labour leader, here's the message, here's the flag. One group, here's a Labour leader, here's the message. The people taking part in this experiment don't know that they're seeing, they just see the one thing. But it did elicit a more positive reaction amongst Conservative voters, slightly more negative reaction amongst Labour voters, which is interesting too.
But if you're in the business of trying to appeal to Tory voters, you can see therefore why they're doing it. We've also seen in the past, sort of Jeremy Corbyn was painted by his critics as not being on the side of Britain. And it wasn't because he didn't have the flag, but it was because of the sort of the stances he took, his attitude towards international organisations or, you know, the West or Russia and so on. And I suppose that's a different sort of patriotism. It's not just about a flag, it's a sort of whose side are you on argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a massively important theme, hasn't it? A kind of a potential defining line in politics over recent years in America. So if you think about, you know, put America first. Now, the problem with that is, of course, is people will have different interpretations of what it means to put Britain first, either in a sort of let's just focus on our country and let's put up trade barriers and all the rest of it, or let's have a more internationalist, more outward looking approach could also be seen as being in Britain's interest. So I think, you know, that's one where the framing of that and how it's interpreted is up for debate, I think. You know, what's particularly interesting since 2017 and 2019, that the big dividing line in electoral behaviour and how people vote is really one about age these days. Age and educational attainment, and those things are, you know, intrinsically linked. So since the Brexit referendum, and to some degree before that, but very much accelerated by the issue of Brexit, we've seen this age divide become incredibly important. And what that's done is it's made the kinds of issues that always divided people on the basis of age and those kinds of issues be more important to how people are assessing politics and assessing political parties. So if you think about issues of immigration, issues of nationalism, those things are, you know, very significantly intertwined. And here we have this kind of, you know, concept of the nation state, concept of also, I think, protecting things that people might feel are being lost. So this sense of loss, this sense of, you know, huge, dramatic, transformational changes in the country, multiculturalism, globalization, economic transformations. And this is a way, I think, quite a effective, potentially, way, at the margins, you know, it's quite subtle, of kind of reassuring people that I'm on the side of, you know, traditionalism, the nation, I understand those things that you might be worried about having some kind of sense of loss about. So I think in that context, it makes quite a lot of sense.
Really fascinating that. From Jane Green, Professor Jane Green, Director at the Nuffield Politics Research Centre. And obviously there's an interesting thing going on here, because traditionally we think of the right wrapping themselves in the flag, but the left's relationship with the flag, the St. George's Cross, the Union Jack, with a sense of Englishness, it can be quite full, as we were discussing there with Jeremy Corbyn. Well, Caroline Lucas is the Green MP, former leader of the Green Party, and she's tried to tackle this in a new book called Another England, How to Reclaim Our National Story. And she told me why she wanted to tackle this idea, this concept of Englishness.
My case essentially is that within a generation, the United Kingdom as we know it may no longer be as we know it. And debates are going on in the three other nations of the UK about what their futures are. And in England, we just typically poddle on and don't really think about it. And to the extent that we do think about it, and this was so interesting in an article that Keir Starmer wrote for The Telegraph over the weekend, to the extent that we do think about it, we constantly muddle England and Britain. So Keir Starmer had obviously been told that he needed to say something for St George's Day. And so he wrote this article about how Labour was the true party of England and St George's Day. And yet throughout the whole article, he was using the words England and Britain totally interchangeably. And that, I just think, speaks volumes. I think there's an arrogance there that because, you know, the Westminster government is based in London and there's an assumption that what's good for England is good for the United Kingdom as a whole. And we've seen it as well with the way in which Scotland in particular was treated through the Brexit referendum. You know, there was no thought that if one of the nations of the UK voted differently from the others, what that would mean in terms of whether we should stay or whether we should leave. So we still went for the hardest of all Brexit, even though Northern Ireland and Scotland voted against and Wales and England voted in favour. So I think this idea of the UK as a union of four equal nations has been demonstrated to be the myth that it really is.
And so who are you trying to reclaim Englishness from?
I'm trying to reclaim Englishness from people like Boris Johnson and the populists and the right-wing governments, people who blather on to the extent they talk about England, you know, that it's all about being world-beating and exceptionalist and imperial nostalgia. You know, Boris Johnson rocks up in Myanmar and starts quoting Kipling and you know, just doing the most ignorant things and offensive things. So it feels to me that there is a radical tradition of Englishness, which is around powers for access to the land, that for landless people has been a real thread through English history, through English literature. And we can reclaim some of these more progressive ideas about what England is, rather than feeling that it's a subject that's off limits and therefore we don't go there. And therefore we basically leave the pitch empty for the right to define what England is. And if we are coming to a point over the next, I don't know what it will be, 10 or 20 years, where England might stand alone one way or another, then I think it's important that progressives get onto the pitch and start to define what we think it is too.
There's obviously a lot of conversation, particularly around St George's Day, about the England flag.
Yeah.
Would you fly the England flag at home?
Do you know, I wouldn't do it tomorrow because I think you need to have the debate first. I think that just seeing people wrap themselves in a flag, as we do see now, Keir Starmer and the front bench, you rarely see any of them on any kind of video now without a flag somewhere, you know. Yeah. But I think that's a bit lazy. It's not just a question of sticking a flag up. It is about a conversation about what England means to us, what kind of England we would like to see. And of course, there are things about our country, England in my case, that I love. There are things that I don't love. And I think patriotism doesn't have to mean thinking that your country is better than all other countries. It doesn't have to mean that you are better than all the others, that you can have critiques of your country. And I think I want that kind of nuance about what it means to be England.
What do you think people would think of you if they saw an England flag outside your house?
Well, this is something that I say in the book, that, yeah, you know, it almost depends where the house is. If it's in a, you know, middle-class village, very ancient, next to the church, and there's a flag flying, that probably gives you a very different signal than if it's in an inner-city estate, for example, because these things are so loaded. And I want to unload them a bit and have more a debate about what it is about England that we like and we want to support. And, you know, things like the English football team is a perfect case in point, the multiculturalism that embraces. And Gareth Southgate, I think, has done more than almost anybody to kind of redefine England, meaning something that can belong to everybody, rather than something that is exclusive and exceptionalist.
I suppose it's one of those things where England ends up being in the eye of the beholder. Because if,
yes,
Brighton, lots of people from other parts of England would come to Brighton and think, well, this isn't what I envisage of being Brighton. I suspect if we came to Brighton, we'd see more pride flags and probably Palestinian flags than England flags flying. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem with the left? Almost enthusiastic about flying any flag apart from the England flag?
I don't know. One of the things that I had a big debate with my editor about with the book. The subtitle is How to Reclaim Our National Story. And a part of me would like to have had story in the plural, because I'm not saying there's one England, yeah. You know, and Brighton is as much England as Birmingham or Bognor, you know what I mean? It's not one single identity, and people can have multiple identities, and what's most important to them can be different on a different day of the week or a different time of the day, you know. So this isn't trying to be monolithic, it's just trying to open up the conversation, not saying to people, look, I found this other identity over here, this is the one we're all going to sign up to.
Caroline Lucas, the former leader of the Green Party, Green MP, talking about her book, Another England, How to Reclaim Our National Story. So that's sort of coming at it from the left, taking a look at flags and patriotism on St George's Day. Let's go back now to the 1990s, when political parties trying to be patriotic can sometimes get things a little bit wrong. This is New Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, now regular guest, of course, on the How to Win an Election podcast, telling us about when their attempts to show that they were patriotic went slightly wrong.
My worst moment in stunts involved Fitz the Bulldog in 1997. This was a wonderful party election broadcast in which Fitz the Bulldog, a real bulldog, you know, Bulldog Britain was sort of, New Labour Bulldog Britain was marching into the sort of new sunrise of New Britain. And it was meant to represent, you know, a Britain now more confident, holding its head up in the world and just marching off and, John Prescott was meant to do this stunt and to walk Fitz the Bulldog, you know, for the photographers, not least because we thought it'd be quite funny. I mean, they look so similar. And John didn't turn up. He got delayed on his battle bus, and somebody had to walk Fitz across the grass, you know, in front of all the photographers, and I had to do it. I felt incredibly self-conscious. I looked rather stupid, but I did so. Everyone was clicking away. And I just felt completely ridiculous. The pictures were not bad, but of course the story that came out of it concerned Fitz's genitalia. I mean, people said, you know, Labour makes a dog's bollocks of its own election broadcast. And in the end, in the broadcast itself, they had to be airbrushed out. I mean, they were so big and so prominent.
Peter Mandelson there, talking about when you tried to be patriotic with the bulldog. And people were upset by Fitz's bitsies. Well, I'm joined now by the former Labour Cabinet Minister, John Denham, who's now the Director of the Centre for English Identity and Politics at the University of Southampton. Hi, John.
Hello.
You make the case for progressive patriotism. How does that, you know, it feels like we've got lots of varieties here. We had just heard from Caroline Lucas talking about trying to be patriotic and reclaiming Englishness from the left. What does progressive patriotism mean?
To me, it means talking about England as a nation that is run in the interests of all of its people. I mean, if you looked at England today, you could reasonably say, you know, it's not owned by the people of England, it's not run by the people of England, it's not run in the interests of the people of England. So it's progressive patriotism is about telling a national story about how a nation could work for everybody and everybody could have a role in it and a say in it.
What does that mean in practice? Is that an English Parliament, yeah, or an assembly alongside Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast?
I think there's two types of things. One is certainly making sure that there's English democracy. Probably the thing that all the opinion polls show that people want is for English MPs in Westminster to make laws that only apply to England. That there is support for an English Parliament, but it's much less. Probably people don't want to pay for an entirely separate set of politicians. But let English MPs make the laws on the health service, social care, whatever, that are only going to apply to England, because we've had devolution for 25 years now. So partly it's about democratic decision making. Partly it's about looking at the way in which our economy and our society works and says, is this working for everybody? And if you look at the one hand, the levels of inequality we've got, of wealth, of health, of life expectancy, of education. If you look at the way the water companies, for example, it's our water, it rains on our hills and our rivers. And what do? They make profits overseas and they put the waste into our rivers and seas. These are huge parts of our economy and society that are not run in the interests of the people of England. And that's what progressive patriotism is. So it's, you know, for some, that will be a particularly left-wing view. For others, it won't be. The test we all agree on is, does this work for the common good of the people of England?
And in terms of the flag, Keir Starmer's warned against the St George's flag being surrendered to the far right. But then a few weeks back, He faced some discontent from Labour MPs over the dominant use of the Union Jack, the Union flag, in some election campaign material, some saying it might alienate minority voters and others. So how do you feel about this? We heard earlier from Jane Green that actually, if you have a politician putting forward a policy with a flag in the background, particularly Conservative voters, the people obviously that Labour need to win over, are more receptive to it. So what? But then does Keir Starmer need to worry that some on the left and on the left of the Labour Party are a bit squeamish about the flag?
Well, there's undoubtedly a minority, and it's quite a small minority, largely of university-educated, younger Liberal voters, who really turn against the idea of patriotic nationhood entirely, whether that's English or British. But I think any politician has to make the judgment that there are far more people who actually do have a level of pride. It's not necessarily a tub-thumping patriotism, but a level of pride in their nation. And for most people in England, it is people are both English and British to different degrees. And I think the thing the Labour Party for me got wrong a few weeks ago was to only put the Union Jack on material, but only did that in England. Whereas in Wales, you had the Welsh symbol, in Scotland, you had the Scottish symbol. In England, Labour wrote England itself out of the story. Yet most of the policy that Keir Starmer talks about is for England. You know, if Wes Streeting becomes Health Secretary, he will be the Health Secretary for England, not for Britain or for the United Kingdom. So I think what's happening today is a bit of a rebalancing and bringing England back into the story. The second obvious thing to make is that if you never show the flag, you do allow other people to come along and claim it. And one of the best ways of saying that the England flag belongs to everyone is for the Labour Party, which at the moment at least is well ahead in the polls, to say we are happy to incorporate the England flag in our campaigning and our message. Mm. It becomes much more difficult then for people to say the left can't fly the St. George cross. So those people who say don't do it, they're being defeatist, I think, and harming their own interests.
Just finally, John, Jeremy Corbyn said he'd make St. George's Day a bank holiday when he was Labour leader. Do you think Keir Starmer should do the same?
I think it's very it's very interesting. When Jeremy Corbyn did that, it was one of the things that polled most support of all of the individual policies that Jeremy Corbyn put forward. It does strike a chord. And of course, he said a bank holiday for each of the national saints within the United Kingdom. I think it's something that Keir Starmer could think about. I would be pretty certain, though, given the state of the economy and all the rest of it at the moment, that creating another holiday is probably a little bit down his list of priorities.
John Dunham, good to speak to you, former Labour Cabinet Minister there. Well, joining me in the studio is Conservative MP for Romford, Andrew Rosendale, who is calling for a Minister for Flags. Andrew, good to see you. What would a Minister for Flags do?
Right, well, first of all, let's get this right. I'm not calling for a Minister for Flags. Mm. What I'm saying is that we need a minister that deals with protocol. What we need is a minister that oversees these things so we don't get things muddled up. At the moment, you've got different government departments all having a say over national symbols. I don't think that's sensible. I think we need one minister accountable to the Prime Minister in the Cabinet Office that deals with all issues regarding national symbols, including flags. And that will avoid some of the misunderstandings, some of the muddles. I mean, I think you may remember a couple of years ago, there was a Union Jack in Downing Street upside down when there was an international delegation coming. Those sort of things need to be ironed out. One minister should be accountable, and it should be a minister for protocol.
Now, you're looking very patriotic today. You've got your St. George's Cross badge. You're wearing a red tie on a white shirt. So it looks like the St. George's Cross. But then your cufflinks, you've got Union Jack. Tell me about why you think, what do you make of this debate about the St. George's Cross in particular?
Right, well, happy St. George's Day.
Yeah, happy St. George's Day.
I think that we, for too long, we've been afraid to promote love of country and belief in England and in Britain. And I am very proud of both identities, of being British and English. But it's not right that often we hear of celebrations for different parts of the United Kingdom, but England doesn't really get a look in. If you're English, it's almost, I don't know, people look down on it. People, the media particularly, are afraid to cover it. But if you're celebrating St. Patrick's Day or even St. Andrew's Day or St. David's Day, it's a great celebration. And I think the people of England have a lot to be proud of. We have an incredible heritage, a magnificent history. Our forebears have done so much and contributed so much to the world, and also these islands, United Kingdom. So we shouldn't be worried about being proud to fly the flag, to show love of country, and to promote St George's Day as our national day for England.
Do you worry as a Conservative MP that Keir Starmer is really parking his tanks on traditional Conservative lords? You wouldn't have seen Jeremy Corbyn doing what he's doing. Videos marking St George's Day, telling people to fly the flag, putting the flag, you know, it's absolutely reaching into core Tory voter base.
I welcome the fact that the Labour Party at last seemed to be promoting the Union Jack and the idea of Englishness. Great. It's taken a long time to get there. They voted not to fly the Union Jack above the town hall in Romford, which is my constituency. And for years, if you display the Union Jack or the Cross of St George, they've accused you of all sorts of things. But suddenly they realise that actually the British people and the English people are very proud of their country. And what John Denham said was absolutely right. If you don't fly the flag, if you're not proud of your heritage, others will claim it. And I think we've done an amazing job in the last few decades in reclaiming the Union Jack. There was a time when the Union Jack seemed to be something that only the National Front would fly and use, or the Cross of St George was a flag used by football hooligans. Well, that's changed now. I think you'll see both flags flown proudly from public buildings, from businesses, from organisations. So we've made a lot of progress in that. But I do urge everyone to take the political correctness out of this, because we're still getting it. We're still getting people, I'm afraid, mainly on the left, who simply don't like national identity and want to put that aside. And I think that's wholly wrong. I think it's very divisive. I think we need to bring everyone together. We're all British. And we're all English. You don't have to be necessarily born in England or born in Britain to feel that you are part of our national family. And so our national symbols are very important.
Just finally, Amanda's been in touch saying, I always think a big England flag flown from a flagpole in a front garden looks a bit confrontational. Just wave a little one. I mean, is that sort of thing that got Emily Thorby into trouble all those years ago? Do you fly a flag in your garden?
I don't fly a flag in my garden. But I do have headquarters in my constituency in Romford. It's called Margaret Thatcher House. It's
very good.
Great building. And we have several Union Jacks flying, three major flag poles. One is a Union Jack, Union flag. One is a Cross of St George. And the third flag is the flag of the County of Essex, of which Romford is proud to be a part.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of Politics Out the Boring Bits. Don't forget to hit subscribe and tell your friends so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.